You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Teamsters Joint Council 56 and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 124. Teamsters Joint Council 56 and our nine local unions represent 30,000 workers, retirees, and their families in western Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. We're proud to support the Heartland Labor Forum and their commitment to give working families a voice in the greater Kansas City community. And the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers supports the Heartland Labor Forum. We've been wiring Kansas City since 1905. If you're not finding your electrical contractor at IBEWLocal124.org, then you're not getting the best value for your money. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, two ballot initiatives in the November 6th election in Missouri affect our democracy and our economy. This week, or tonight, on the Heartland Labor Forum, we'll explore Amendment 1, called Clean Missouri, which limits campaign and lobbying donations to the state legislature and determines how we redistrict and Proposition B, Raise Up Missouri, which would raise the state's minimum wage from $7.85 an hour to $12 an hour by 2023. In the news, Iowa public employee unions mainly survive another year of the law aimed at destroying them. And as Homeland Security prepares for the migrant caravan, we ask, are there Middle Eastern terrorists hiding among those baby strollers? Our feature at the end of the show is Safety First with Mary Aereo. Her stories include miscarrying at work, Trump's OSHA softens Obama-era restrictions on drug testing, and safety incentives, and Environmental Protection Agency to consider continued use of hazardous paint stripper. Now for the news.
And this is the news from our side, November 1st, 2018. Tomorrow there will be a solidarity picket for striking Marriott workers in front of the Marriott Hotel at 45th and Main at 5 p.m. It's being organized by the local branch of the IWW, or the Industrial Workers of the World. The Marriotts in Kansas City are not on strike, and in fact, they're not even unionized. So this is just an informational picket in solidarity with the Marriott workers in eight cities who have been out on strike for 3 weeks. Labor journalist David Bacon writes today, 3 weeks on the picket line will either weaken a strike or make it stronger. But he says that there are no signs the workers want to go back to work anytime soon, at least not without resolving the reasons why they went on strike to begin with. Instead, the noise on the picket line is getting louder. Workers bang on pots, drums, even old folding chairs, making a racket loud enough to penetrate thick walls and double-paned windows. As a result, many hotel guests not dissuaded by their initial encounters with picketing workers are now giving up and leaving. Also, conferences are pulling out of a number of Marriott venues, but in Boston, the New York Yankees and Los Angeles Dodgers did not cancel hotel reservations for their baseball teams. Instead, ballplayers, themselves a member of a union, snuck into the rear entrances of struck hotels as workers yelled questions to them about their apparent lack of solidarity. To get Marriott's directors to pay attention to the union's demands, the picket lines have been augmented by street actions and marches. 41 hotel strikers and supporters were arrested on October 12th for sitting in front of Marriott's San Francisco flagship hotel, the Marquis. In Oakland, a week later, hundreds of strikers and supporters took over the intersection outside the hotel entrance. As the police stood without intervening, children painted the strike slogan in huge letters on the asphalt. One job should be enough. The slogan underlines the main demand by Unite Here in negotiations: enough pay so that workers don't have to work a second job in order to survive.
After losing control of their state legislature to right-wing Republicans in 2016, Iowa public sector labor unions were forced to recertify every 2 years. Predictions were that most would become extinct or drop representation in the face of this extremely burdensome requirement. But just this week, 21 Iowa public employees unions representing state workers for collective bargaining of contracts have all won recertification elections, according to unofficial results from the Iowa Public Employment Relations Board. The Des Moines Register reported the unofficial results from more than 400 additional local bargaining units, which showed the vast majority were also winning recertification. That includes bargaining units for cities, counties, school districts, community colleges, and area education agencies. The preliminary counts, which are subject to challenges for 10 days, show that state workers overwhelmingly decided they wanted to continue being represented by public employees unions. However, at least 22 small local bargaining units failed to obtain recertification because of lack of yes votes from a majority of eligible public employees. If an eligible voter does not vote in a union election, it is essentially the same as a no vote. The largest state workers units are represented by AFSCME, or the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. The technical bargaining unit had 4,762 workers eligible to vote. A total of 3,619 voted yes, and just 15 voted no. The AFSCME Fiscal and Staff Unit, the second largest, had 4,389 eligible to vote. A total of 3,295 voted yes, and just 20 voted no. In the Des Moines Independent Community School District, the Des Moines Education Association was approved with 2,769 yes votes and 33 no votes. Last year, the Missouri legislature passed a similar law. It is being challenged in the court.
As our president trumps up the hysteria around the caravan of babies and strollers and their families fleeing the failed states of Honduras and El Salvador, his government is struggling to make room for them in ICE jails along the border. Consequently, they are releasing thousands, according to reports from San Diego, El Paso, and Tucson. Unlike the past, when people were often given bus tickets to get to cities where relatives live and the court dates in those cities, now they're being dumped at shelters and churches or just out on the streets. And they're even putting tracking devices on teenagers. The LA Times reports, in El Paso this week, Homeland Security said it had run out of space in temporary holding areas, even though fewer immigrants are crossing the southern border than in previous years. This manufactured humanitarian crisis has significant health impact on immigrants. The National Nurses Union, NNU, RN response network called RNRN, is working with local agencies to closely monitor the situation on the border and is gathering resources to provide RN support. An immediate need has been identified in San Diego, California, to provide basic first aid and medical triage to immigrants and immigrant families. Needs in other areas, including El Paso, Texas, and Tucson, Arizona, are still emerging and will be monitored closely. NNU is collecting donations for this and asking for nurses to volunteer to go to the border towns. Go to RN Response Network to find more information. And that's the news from our side. The news tonight was read by Jen Zaman, Greg Swartz, and I'm Judy Ansel.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone, for the times they are a-changing. Some writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. 'Cause the loser now will be later to win, for the times they are a-changing.
Okay, this is the Heartland Labor Forum on KKFI 90.1, your community radio. Tonight's program is about a ballot initiative that will be voted upon this Tuesday, November 6, 2018, just around the corner. The common name is Clean Missouri. And here to discuss the Amendment 1 is Paul Washington. Paul, please tell us about your job.
Well, first I want to say thank you for having me online. My name is Paul Washington. I am the Kansas City organizer for Missouri Jobs with Justice. And what we are, a coalition of labor unions and community organizations and schools and community partners who get together and work on things to really put forth an effort to change the economic climate for working class people.
Okay. And then we'll talk about the Amendment 1, which is called Clean Missouri. Paul, briefly summarize or give the top points on the Amendment 1. Can you do that, please?
Yeah. So, you know, when we ran the ballot initiative to collect the signatures, it was called Clean Missouri. And I think that was very appropriate because our intent behind this is to really clean up our legislature and to make sure that everything is running as efficiently as possible. So now we're going with Amendment 1 because that's what it is listed on the ballot in November 6th. So everybody remember that. The key point, the first thing it's going to do, it's going to eliminate almost all lobbyist gifts. And the reason why we want to do that is simply because we think that moneyed interest plays a big part in the way that people make decisions, and they're not necessarily listening to their constituents.
Right.
I think the next part is, like, we want to lower the campaign contribution limit. We want to have it at $2,500 for state and $2,000 for Senate, and then $2,000 for state representatives. And it's the same reasoning.
Okay. And then now we'll go into a non-controversial thing. In other words, we have opposition. The person is former Senator Jim Talent, who is the chair of First Missourians, and he feels this is okay. So would you go into more detail in the finance issues addressed by Clean Missouri?
Well, I think, you know, when we're out on the when we were out talking to folks about campaign finance reform, I think in general the people believe that they're not necessarily being heard, and one of the reasons why they don't think that they're being heard is because moneyed interest has played a huge part of Missouri politics for a really long time. It is bipartisan, is very popular from right. folks on both sides. I have not heard too much pushback. I mean, there are those folks
right.
who think that limiting how much money they can give is the crime. Not necessarily, they're not disagreeing. that money shouldn't dictate our policies, but they're disagreeing with it on a – they're saying that it's their right to do what they want. It's not really against the idea of
– Okay. Now, what is the state legislature and the staff – what about lobbying, as you're saying? What does it do about the lobbyist itself? If a person wants to – after they're – elected and they get off.
Yeah, right.
What happens then?
So right now, I think we have a huge problem. You know, I hear representatives talk about like how lobbyists are the longest lasting people in Jeff City because they don't term out. But there's also another problem with making sure that people are really listening to their constituents. If you, let's say, if you're a representative now and you want to become a lobbyist, right, like some of the decisions you make are almost like a job interview. So what we want to do is we want to make sure that people are paying attention to this job and this job only. So it puts a mandate in there that they will not be able to become a lobbyist for 2 years after.
And that includes, which it doesn't now, is staff members or employees of the legislators, right? Isn't that true, too?
I'm not sure to what extent. There are limitations. I can...
Well, that's all right, because that's what they've said, is that the employees cannot... They're in the two-year realm, too.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense.
Right.
We might double-check that for
all
a second.
All right. Okay. And that now we're going to go with the major thrust of the amendment, and that is map drawing. In other words, this is where the controversy comes into. You know, I just mentioned Senator Talent, or former Senator Talent. You know anybody else that is against this thing? Or,
you know, nobody that I think we should know.
Okay. Dan, is it Dan Headed, Republican from the 12th District, or senatorial district? And then there's another one, Sarah Walls, mm-hmm. also is a state rep that is working toward making sure that it fails.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got this, and again, some of the things that are being said is that it already is. In other words, Jim Talent says you can get people elected as governor and senator. You've even got a senator right now that's Democrat. So what's the, you know, that's the question that they ask is, it's okay. And so there was another thing, and I just let you go with it after I say it, is that they feel that this will cause less black legislators because of the way they would gerrymander and that kind of thing. So I'm just curious what your take is on that.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think you're right. This is probably the most controversial. At least this is the point that we use to make this controversial. I actually don't think that this is controversial at all. So the way it is set up now, we can get people elected in some places.
Right.
Places that are actually compact and contiguous, like the federal mandate, right? But it's not like that everywhere. So what we're really trying to address with this is sort of like the efficiency gaps, right? The wasted votes, the
right.
votes that are really pulled into districts in order to main control in another district. That's simply just not going to happen in groups in you know, the urban core, right?
Right.
Is mainly people of color. But the outskirts of Missouri are also changing demographics, right? So
right.
like our rules as they currently are not really set up to deal with the changing demographic. And I think that's what's
right.
what makes some people uncomfortable. I think we really need to look at and focus. Like this bill, if you want to talk about like minority groups,
right.
This actually puts in protections that don't exist for minority groups. And I mean, if you give me a second, I'll just read
Go
the
ahead.
Actual language, right? Notwithstanding any other provision of this article, districts shall not be drawn with the intent or result of denying or abridging the equal opportunity of racial or language minority to participate in the political process or dismantling their ability to elect representatives of their choice, whether by themselves or by voting in concert with other persons.
Okay.
This is language that does not exist.
Right.
This adds the words fair and competitive to our state constitution, which, you know, if you are for democracy, right, this is something that you would think one would be aligned with.
Right. Now, with this kind of thing, they've also said that the idea of separate bills, why didn't this become a separate bill? In other words, like I said, Jim Talon is saying this is all right on this side, but this gerrymandering type thing they're talking about is not good. So why was it put together?
So I think we wanted a comprehensive package. And I think probably from the opposition's point, like, they're not so – I don't know, because, like I said, the campaign finance reform, a lot of folks are already on board with that. It's very bipartisan. I think from a legislative standpoint, from somebody who's in political power, the thing that may actually hold them to more accountability is the thing that they're worried about. So that's maybe why I can only, you know, assume.
Right.
But the reason we ran them together, we wanted a complete package, and we wanted it to be a constitutional amendment so it could not be as easily changed. If it goes to court and it's found to be unconstitutional, then that's one thing. But it's also another thing for us to not do it and then kind of remain in the world as it is.
With that concept, what is the difference between a proposition and an amendment? What is the reasoning that we went with an amendment rather than a proposition?
So amendments are a lot more strong. There are very little things that legislators could do to actually change what the voters say on an amendment. Proposition can easily be, they can easily write, legislation to counteracted or things of that nature, and they could just put it through. It doesn't take the signatures to get rid of, from the legislature.
Right. In other words, the way I hear it, that amendment, you would have to do the same thing to get it repealed. You'd have to get all the people to vote again.
Yes.
In order to get it out. So that would make it a strong bill. But do you consider that it might be taken to the court? It was taken to the court.
So it has already been taken to the court. And there was, the single subject rule, which is something that's come up before. I think as it stands, it was forced to be put on the ballot this November.
Right.
It was ruled that, the folks have to vote on it. I'm sure over time, maybe they continue to press this in the courts, the opposition to this. But that's just how we know that something's really going to change. We want to spend a lot of money in the court system.
Right. All right. So you've had it in the court. It may still get that way.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is who basically is supporting this?
So, there's a lot of grassroots efforts to really drive home, like, why Clean Missouri or Amendment 1 is important.
Right.
I want to point out, one, Missouri Jobs with Justice
is definitely
a supporter. We have the Missouri AFL-CIO. We have the Missourians Healthcare for All. We have the Missouri State Conference of the NAACP.
Right.
We have Take Back Our Republic. And as far as, notable senators, Senator Rob Schaff, he's a Republican senator.
Right.
We have Kathleen Boswell, president of the League of Women Voters of Missouri. There's a huge list of organizations and people who are really invested in democracy who are putting their name on this.
Right, and then on the other side, you have, like I say, former Senator Jim Talon, who is a good person, and they've also talked about the Chambers of Commerce, the Economic and Industry Chamber of Commerce is backing this. Why would you think they do? Why do you think they want that?
You're saying they're backing the opposition?
They're helping with the opposition.
Yeah, so, if you look at the Missouri Chamber of Commerce and you look at what this entire, thing is to do, is to take big money out of politics. And I think there are a lot of individual interests that really do lead our legislator, and those would be the folks who may feel like we're taking away some of their ability to do that.
Right. Now, I'm going to ask you an odd question, and it is
okay.
Odd in a way. Why did they move it down to $5 gift? What can you get for $5? Why not just not have it? if you're not gonna do it, I mean, I would think that 20 or something like that, it would be okay. But five, what would they give? How would that wouldn't affect anything, would it?
So the $5 rule is what we also call the coffee cup rule,
okay.
Right? Like, one, we live in a world where money is spent all of the time.
Right.
Right. And if you're going to be a lobbyist and you want to meet with the legislators, it should not feel like a gift, but it's not like so extreme that you guys can't sit down and you purchase a cup of coffee for that person. So that's where that rule comes from. It's, you know, even on an interpersonal level, like, it's easy for me to spend $5 on you, Lon, like if we go out to lunch or something or even just to go get coffee at some establishment.
Right.
So that's why it's $5.
Okay, I was just curious because it, out of all these things, now, the one thing that Talent said about this deal was there wasn't that much difference between $2,000 for a state rep, $2,500 for a state rep or a state senator, but the total was for both $2,600. So why did they split those two?
You know, I can't speak to why that language was chosen or what that dollar amount, where that dollar amount came from.
Right. Now, what we have here is a way of helping solve some of the problems, but is it too strong? Is it too much in there so that there isn't any leeway for things to happen and this kind of thing? Is there some sense of flexibility?
I mean, I think this is very comprehensive, and if you read through the actual language that gets put forth towards the Constitution, like if one part gets shot down in some areas, it doesn't affect other things. So, like, we'll see, you know, what comes of it. I don't think it's too strong. I don't. I actually think that our problem with money and politics is a lot bigger than Clean Missouri can just address right now. But this is the first step for us to taking back our legislator.
Well, is there any other way, like a changing the culture in Jeff City? In other words, without this, would there be something else that could be done?
I mean, I think, you know, if you're talking about changing the culture in Jeff City, the first thing we have to do is be able to get people elected who are actually going to, you know, represent you. That's the first thing.
All right.
And you know, there's a cultural shift happening on a national level right now. And I think, you know, people are waking up and paying attention to what's actually happening. You know, one thing we didn't mention about this is like it's going to add more transparency and accountability.
All right. Right? What would that transparency mean? What is that?
So right now, like let's say with the redistricting, right? Like if the you know, maps are public. But how they came to that conclusion is not public. How the maps have been drawn, like what decisions were made in order to draw the lines the same way or draw the lines a certain way, that's not public. And then if it goes to court because, you know, it's not accepted and then it goes to a court, even after it goes to court, it's not available for us to see.
Right.
Nobody really to check the decision-making process.
There's also the concept that they talk about is that those working in Jeff City, the employees of legislators, are going to have to that be reported too. What they're spending and what they're getting.
Yeah, it's very comprehensive.
It's very comprehensive. Mm-hmm. And that. Why couldn't that have been done without all this? That's what it was, just curiosity, because this is a much bigger thing than a lot of people thought. So it's going to take some people to want to really do this. And then there's the other group that have a good argument for what they're saying. And so, therefore, I really believe that we have something that can change things. And it may even spur something else, even
Absolutely.
If it goes down.
Absolutely. You know, and when I talk to folks about the election in November, I don't tell people how to vote. I don't ask people to vote my way. I ask them to think about their self-interest. And when I think about my self-interest in this, one of the key things is that we're going to be able to change some things after this.
All right. And so what we have here is now we want everybody in the entire state that are registered to vote to vote.
Absolutely. Do your research and go vote.
Right. And the other part of that is there's a quote by a person that I liked in my disability movement, and that is Justin Dart, who said, vote like your life depended on it, because it does.
Amen.
And that's it. There you go.
Well, thanks for having me, Lon.
Right. And we want both sides to be there.
Yeah.
Yep.
KKFI is a non-commercial radio station. That means we receive financial support from our community marketing partners. These partners share information about their organizations or events while supporting KKFI's mission. Learn more at kkfi.org/marketing.
Thanks so much to Californos for sustaining our volunteers during this last fun drive. We appreciate it when a family-owned business supports KKFI. For the entire 30 years that KKFI has been on the air, Californos has been a supporter. Thanks to the staff and the Barksdale, Burns, Lillig, and Swift families. We look forward to another 30 years of partnership.
This retired federal employee, Bill Claus, is encouraging all my federal employee friends to please consider supporting KKFI during this year's combined federal campaign. That's CFC code 21994. Just a few dollars a week on payroll deductions won't mean much to you, but it'll mean big bucks to us at KKFI. So please consider supporting KKFI. That's agency code 21994.
Grandpa was a laborer, working with his hands, supporting his wife and family, an honest working man. He rose before the sun, and he came home late at night. He worked until the day that the whiskey took his life. Years later, I'm working just like him. Except that I need two jobs now, just to pay the rent. No wife, no kid, no student loan, just every day expense. When I get my hard-earned pay, it's already spent. I want my living wage, I want my living wage. A hard day's work for a hard day's pay. I want my living wage, I want my living wage, I want my living wage. Hard day's work for a hard day's pay. I want my living wage.
And that was Living Wage by Kansas City band The Uncouth. Welcome back to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Sean Saving. Well, if you believe everything you hear on the news, which I don't recommend you do, the economy is booming. GDP is up, unemployment is down, everything is in place for serious growth and prosperity for Americans, or so it would seem. But there's just one nagging problem economists can't seem to figure out. Why aren't wages growing? Sure, they are up recently, but they are barely keeping pace with inflation. Year over year for September, average hourly wages increased by just 0.5% after inflation. And for non-supervisory employees, that increase was just 0.2%. And remember, these are averages, so large gains at the top can skew the metric. For those at the bottom half of the income distribution, wages, which are already too low, are remaining flat. Economists have posited a number of reasons why wages aren't keeping up, and we're going to talk about one of them tonight, the minimum wage, which at the federal level has been stuck at $7.25 an hour since 2009. Fortunately, because of a voter-passed referendum in 2006, the minimum wage for most workers in Missouri is slightly higher at $7.85, and it does get adjusted for inflation every year. Yet that still pales in comparison to the peak buying power of the minimum wage in 1968, when it was equivalent to $10.79 in today's dollars. That is why a large coalition of labor and economic justice advocates have come together to raise the state's minimum wage to $12 an hour by 2023. They call themselves Raise Up Missouri, and Proposition B is the referendum voters will be deciding on next Tuesday. With us tonight via phone is Wilson Vance, a community organizer for Raise Up Missouri. Wilson, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So tell us, why do low-wage workers in Missouri need a raise?
Well, the cost of groceries, as you said, and housing and health care and our other basics in Missouri have been going up for years, but our wages simply have not kept pace. Right now, someone in Missouri who works full-time for minimum wage only earns $314 a week. That's barely $16,000 a year. And that's nowhere near enough to cover basics like food and rent. I mean, in fact, the minimum wage today has less buying power than it did in the 1960s. And I think everyone should agree that no one who works full-time should have to live in poverty or should struggle to make ends meet. So Prop B would raise Missouri's minimum wage gradually to $12 an hour by 2023, and that would help nearly 260,000 Missouri children who live with a parent who earns low wages, 100,000 seniors and near retirees working hard just to make ends meet, and also small local businesses as low-wage workers spend new earnings in their own communities.
So how does this wage, you said it goes up gradually. How does that happen?
So the current rate is $7.85 an hour, and it would go up to $8.60 in 2019, and then it would go up 85 cents a year until it reaches $12 an hour by 2023, and then it would be indexed for inflation.
Okay, so that's a pretty gradual increase. We're talking five more years to get to go up from $7.85 to $12, which is a $4.15 increase over 5 years. You know, a lot of people work for even less than the minimum wage, technically, on what their employer pays them. They're tipped employees. How are they covered by this law? I know currently in Missouri, they get 50% of the state minimum wage. So what would that continue in this new bill?
Yeah. So under Proposition B, it would increase accordingly for tipped workers at the same rate. So Prop B doesn't change the way tipped workers are treated under the law, but their wages would still go up as the overall minimum wage increases.
And after 2023, is it indexed to inflation after that still?
Yeah.
Okay, so that doesn't change either. All right. So this is sort of a catch-up sort of type of provision here. 5 years, we hopefully caught up to a more reasonable rate that would then stay tied to inflation over time.
Exactly.
You know, one of the things that I noticed in this bill is that there are some workers that are excluded from these increases. Can you tell us who is covered, who's not actually covered by this?
Yeah, so Prop B exempts state employees, and that's because Missouri law prevents the appropriation of funds by ballot initiative. Otherwise, Proposition B doesn't change anything in existing state law regarding workers that are exempted. So I don't have the full list of exemptions in front of me, but it does include some agricultural workers, seasonal workers, like someone who's working at a summer day camp for kids, golf caddies, a few others.
Huh. Okay. So is it fairly similar to the existing exemptions?
Yes. Yeah.
Are local government, I guess, and county government as well are also excluded because of this, like what would you call it? You can't allocate money through a referendum. So that's what
precisely.
Okay. So presumably the governments would want to square up their employees they had making less than $12 an hour. You would hope. I mean, it's hard to believe that there are government employees making less than $8 or $9 an hour right now. But they do exist, I guess.
Right.
You know, this is a union show, so we have a lot of people who are in labor unions who listen. They have contracts, and some of them are fairly low-wage contracts. I don't think the janitors in a lot of places make a ton of money, and it's possible they have contract wages that may be lower than the minimum wage. Do you know what happens in that case for those workers?
So under current law, contracts should adhere to minimum wage standards, and nothing in Proposition B would change that.
So would an existing contract stay in effect, or would it have to be superseded by the law if it came in? Do you know?
I actually don't know. I don't know, and so I don't want to.
Okay.
I don't want to say I assume they would go up, but I do assume that they would have to adhere to the law.
Right. Okay. No problem. You know, for years, you know, the call out there in the public, everybody's been hearing, you know, from everybody from the fast food workers to Bernie Sanders, is $15 an hour. Like, a lot of people are asking, well, why is this only going to 12? Don't we really want 15? Isn't that the standard? Isn't that what everybody's asking for? Why 12?
Well, so states have been raising their minimum wage all over the country to different levels. So Arkansas, for instance, is actually working on raising their minimum wage to $11 an hour.
Okay.
Some have done lower, some have done higher. But, you know, we know that in Missouri, there's no community in the entire state, no county in the entire state where someone can afford to raise a family on $314 a week.
Right.
And so raising our minimum wage to $12 an hour is going to honor the work of hardworking women and men across the state, and it is going to help them quite a bit in making their ends meet. At the same time, it's going to help small businesses by injecting over $1 billion in new consumer buying power as those wages go up.
So, but wouldn't 15 also do that?
Sure. So we feel like Proposition B is an excellent step that will help workers and businesses. You know, so I grew up in a minimum wage household, and my mom, she often worked more than one job, two, three jobs at a time, and a lot of the times worked more than full time, and we still struggled. And so I know that if something like Prop B had happened when I was a kid, that would have meant a lot to us. Like, we may have been able to get a car, or we may have been able to move out of our one-bedroom apartment and go to a two-bedroom apartment. So, you know, $12 an hour may not sound like a lot to people, but for someone who's making $7.85, it means a great deal.
So is that, I mean, I assume to some degree $12 was chosen because I know that multiple levels were filed with the Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. I assume this was a compromise between what they think will pass, and is 15 maybe thought too high for Missouri voters? Is that part of the rationale for why 12 was what the organization went with?
Sure, you could say that. I think more so it's what, how much of a raise can we get for the most people, and how can we also be supporting small businesses at the same time?
So not making it too much pressure. I mean, I'm not even disagreeing that with you with the 12 level. I just was trying to figure out. I know a lot of people are wondering why we're not doing 15. I mean, I think part of it would be, of course, if you're in rural parts of the state, you know, mm-hmm. cost of living is a lot lower than Kansas City or Missouri. I mean, heck, I think what wasn't Kansas City trying to raise theirs to 15 then it was preempted by the state, right? I mean, I think it was actually going much higher. Whereas I could see, like, somewhere in the Boot Heel or somewhere like Northwest Missouri, 15 might really be a lot higher than most businesses could stand to take on. You know, I want to – so Missouri is kind of – we got a couple of things we can do here. We can do statutory laws, or like in the last earlier segment, we were talking about the Clean Initiative. That's a constitutional amendment. This is not a constitutional amendment, right? This is a regular statutory initiative. So doesn't that mean that the legislature could actually overturn it? I mean, this has happened before in this state with these kinds of initiatives. We pass them, and then the legislature comes in and says, nah, sorry. You know, like the last one was the puppy mill bill a few years ago. Are you concerned that the legislature, you know, with Republican-controlled House and Senate and a governor, that we could pass this and they may just say, sorry, we're not going to do it, and just overturn it?
Well, sure. But in every legislative district in Missouri, like every single one, there are people who are going to benefit from this. And it would frankly be a slap in the face of voters if the legislature overturned their will. So any legislator who did do that, who voted to overturn an increase to our minimum wage, they're going to have to explain themselves to someone in our district who's working full-time, someone who's making $314 a week. They're going to have to tell that person why they think that they don't matter and why their work doesn't matter. So we're going to do everything we can to defend it.
So you think that this is a popular enough referendum that they're not going to want to touch it, is that what you're saying?
That is certainly what I'm hoping.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I hope that's true. You know, we've seen the Missouri legislature defy the will of the people on many, many occasions. And I know they tried many times to overturn the existing minimum wage law. I know that Jobs with Justice and groups like that were really successful and worked hard to fight those challenges off. And I guess it all will depend, too, on if anything changes with the balance of power in the legislature next Tuesday. I know right now I think the Republicans have veto-proof majorities in both the House and the Senate. I don't know how many Republicans in the Senate are minimum wage friendly, but I guess we'll find out. I want to remind our listeners, this is the Heartland Labor Forum. We are discussing Proposition B, the initiative to raise Missouri's minimum wage. I'm talking with Wilson Vance from the Raise Up Missouri campaign. So I need to, since there is no formal opposition that's been filed for Proposition B, it's mostly just the usual suspects that I think anybody who follows Missouri politics knows who those that's going to be, like the Show Me Institute and Rex Singfield and all of his libertarian rich buddies. They've been making the same old, age-old arguments, I think, that about a higher minimum wage that I've been hearing for a long time. And they say that, you know, higher wages are going to cause employers to cut back on workers' hours and reduce hiring. It's going to hurt low-wage workers and the economy overall because, you know, in fact, they might get more money per hour, but they're going to end up cutting their hours back because businesses can't afford it. I mean, what do you say to that argument? That's generally still the same argument they've been making. What's your answer to that?
Yeah, their arguments haven't changed. But the great thing is that we now have decades of information on what happens when the minimum wage is increased, as it has been in over half the states in America. You know, and across the board, data shows that when states raise the minimum wage, workers' incomes go up and the unemployment rate goes down. You know, this is a tested solution. And all the research shows that these claims of job loss are just not true. I mean, we also know from studies of Prop B that one quarter of all Missouri workers, that's 677,000 workers, will benefit from this.
That's workers who are at or near minimum wage, right? I mean, those are workers who are also that'll all see their wages go up because everybody else is around them is going up. Is that the what you're saying?
Yes, precisely.
Because if you push up the bottom, anybody who's making slightly above minimum wage, they're going to demand more money from their employer,
mm-hmm.
right? Well, I know that, for example, the National Employment Law Project released a study last spring, and it looked at a number of different studies over the recent years that have very, very good controls on comparing apples to apples. Some are comparing one county next to another county that raised wages, one didn't, and looked at job losses and job gains and have found, I guess, basically these sort of minimum wage increases that are gradual don't really seem to have an effect on employment growth. That's the gut feeling people have, right? I mean, if people have more money to spend, if poor people have more money, they're going to spend it, right? I mean, that's the idea.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's going to inject over $1 billion into Missouri's economy, and that's a lot of money into the hands of local businesses.
Yeah, because those people will go spend it. I mean, if you only make an $8-$9 an hour, you're going to spend it, right?
Absolutely. I mean, people are going to go out and they're going to buy groceries, they're going to get their cars fixed, they're going to do home repairs, they're going to buy clothing. That's what happens when people make more money, is they go out and they spend it. I mean, secondly, you know, the minimum wage, it results in happier, more loyal employees. And those folks stay in their jobs longer. And that means less turnover, which cuts recruitment and job training costs for businesses as well.
Right, turnover.
And that's why, you know, over 600 small businesses have already endorsed the campaign.
Wow.
It's really exciting.
I mean, turnover is actually rather high in these low-wage jobs, right? I mean, 50-60% in retail health. And it costs businesses, I think there was a study I was reading said something about $4,000 to $6,000 per turnover. So you lose an employee, you spend $4,000 or $5,000 training a new one. So
mm-hmm.
if you pay them more, they'll stay, right? That's the idea.
Absolutely.
I want to, you know, one of the other criticisms I should bring up, because like I said, we don't have anybody here from the other side, but I want to, recent Kansas City Star editorial criticized the campaign for its out-of-state dark money, saying that 90% of the campaign's funding came from D.C. and New York-based groups. The implication being that this is not a homegrown campaign and outside agitators are coming into the state and trying to tell us what to do. How do you answer those charges?
Well, first of all, we had hundreds of thousands of people sign petitions from all over the state to get Prop B on the ballot. And we're talking from Kennett, Missouri, all the way up to St. Joseph. Like,
mm-hmm.
this is widely supported all over the state. And we have people knocking on doors every day. We're running a broad-based grassroots campaign that's focused on speaking directly to voters. And our coalition includes organizations that simply agree with the value that $7.85 is not enough and that no one in Missouri who works full-time should live in poverty. And, you know, we're proud to have the support of all the members of that coalition.
Do you know how many volunteers collected signatures to put this on the ballot? Do you have any idea? I know it was several thousand people, right?
Yeah, I don't have the I don't actually have that number. I did. I know I collected signatures myself in Kansas City. And I know Jobs with Justice did quite a bit of that work in Kansas City. Paul might actually, Paul, who you just interviewed for Queen Missouri, he might actually know if he's still there.
I believe Kansas City qualified its congressional district, which is how this is done, with strictly with voluntary signature gatherers, from what I understand. Which is, you know, so, well, you know, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to give people an opportunity if they want to find out more about the campaign. Where should they go if they want to find out what this issue is about? They can do their own research. What's your website?
Sure. If people have, you know, they want to look into it more, they want to get more involved, they can always go to www.raiseupmo.org.
All right. Well, Wilson, thanks for being on the show. Really appreciate it. Now, we hope everybody gets out and votes next week.
Absolutely. Me too. No matter what way you vote, just please get out to the polls. It's really important.
And thank you very much. Like I said, there is no formal opposition to Prop B, so if you want to learn about more of it, get on the internet. It's all out there. You can find all the arguments for it you want to hear, both sides. That was Wilson Vance from the Raise Up Missouri campaign. You're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum on 90.1 FM Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for Safety First with Mary Aereo.
This is Mary Aereo for Safety First. First, miscarrying at work, the physical toll of pregnancy discrimination, from thepumphandle.org and the October 21st New York Times. Reporters with the New York Times recount the experiences of Cedria Walker and Tasha Morell, who experienced miscarriages this year while working at XPO Logistics in Memphis, Tennessee. Both women had notes from their doctors recommending to XPO that their patients be given light duty work. The New York Times reports that XPO management refused to accommodate the pregnant women's needs. Walker and Morell's pregnancies ended with miscarriages. XPO is a contractor for Verizon. Not everyone knows that it is not illegal for an employer to ignore the health needs of a pregnant employee, unlike the Americans for Disabilities Act, which requires employers to provide reasonable accommodation. The 1978 Pregnancy Discrimination Act says an employer only has to accommodate a pregnant worker's needs if the company is already doing so for other employees who are similar in the ability or inability to work. In the last several years, numerous employees at the XPO facility have experienced miscarriages. A Better Balance, a national legal advocacy organization, has supported women who have been discriminated against for being pregnant. In 2017, ABB released a report, It Shouldn't Be a Heavy Lift, Fair Treatment for Pregnant Workers, which describes what some pregnant women experience at work. Here, one is a waitress whose pregnancy caused her to have to urinate more frequently. Her boss made her ask for permission to use the bathroom, but did not make the same demands of other employees. ABB has worked with state lawmakers to pass laws that will ensure pregnant women are provided reasonable job modifications to maintain a healthy pregnancy. They've also worked with federal lawmakers to craft the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act. Will the new Congress take this up? OSHA backs off Obama-era drug testing and safety incentive curves. From EHSToday.com for October 23rd, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration has announced it is softening a hardline approach adopted during the Obama administration, restricting the use of post-accident drug testing employee safety incentive programs. The agency under the Trump administration finds that assumption of employee intimidation is insufficient grounds for restrictions. OSHA sent a memo to its regional administrators on October 11th, that supplies a more permissive interpretation of its regulation, prohibiting employers from discharging or discriminating against employees for reporting a work-related injury or illness. The Obama-era agency had declared that employers could not use drug testing or the threat of drug testing as a form of adverse reaction against employees who report injuries or illnesses. In its October 11th memo, however, the new OSHA leadership under the Trump administration declared the existing rule will not be interpreted as prohibiting the Institute of Workplace Safety Incentive Programs or the implementation of post-incident drug testing. Finally, the Environmental Protection Agency may allow furniture workers to keep using hazardous paint stripper. From Bluebird at www.bna.com, October 17th. The EPA is signaling that commercial furniture refinishers may continue using a paint stripping chemical called methylene chloride, reversing previous plans to significantly restrict both consumer and commercial use. The solvent is one of the top 10 chemicals the agency is re-examining, and major companies like Lowe's, Home Depot, and Walmart have pledged to remove products containing the chemical by the end of the year. The EPA fall regulatory agenda said the scope of the final methylene chloride regulation it's crafting may be narrower than previously proposed by allowing commercial furniture workers to continue to use the chemical under different restrictions than do-it-yourselfers. Under the notice, while EPA proposed to identify the use of methylene chloride in commercial furniture refinishing as presenting an unreasonable risk, EPA intends to further evaluate the commercial furniture refinishing use and develop an appropriate regulatory risk management approach under the Toxic Substance Control Act. Concerns about bathtub refinishers and other home and maintenance worker exposure spread after coating strippers usage resulted in over 63 deaths associated with the use of the solvent in poorly ventilated spaces, primarily by do-it-yourselfers. The deaths were flagged by relatives in meetings with the former EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt last spring. Liz Hitchcock, acting director of the Chemical Safety Coalition Safer Chemicals, Healthy Families, said although it's good the EPA is going forward with some regulatory action, it would also be substantially better if it just didn't protect do-it-yourselfers but also protected commercial workers. This is Mary Ariel for Safety First.
And this is Judy Ansel with the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. Saturdays from 5 to 10 p.m., Lefties Hangout. That's people politically on the left. Email heartlandlaborforum@gmail.com for the location. Canvas for Amendment 1 and Proposition B with Jobs with Justice. Saturday from 11 to 3 at the Jobs with Justice office at 1101 East 87th Street. And Sunday from 2 to 5 out of the SEIU office, 4526 Paseo. Bring a smartphone if you have one. And for more information, you can call Paul at 816-423-1507. First Friday Forum of Empower Missouri is called The Cliff Effect and Minimum Wage. It's a brown bag lunch event. It'll be Friday, November 2nd, 11:30 for networking, 12 o'clock for the program at the KCMO Central Library Vault Room. And Election Debrief with Max Skidmore at Community of Reason, Sunday, November 11th, 2 p.m., UMKC Hag Hall, Room 301, northwest corner of 52nd and Rock Hill. You can find our calendar, our archive shows, and our upcoming schedule on our website, and that is at heartlandlaborforum.org. Also, Souls to the Polls. If you live in Kansas, on Saturday from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., candidates Sharice Davids and Laura Kelly are going to be having rallies, and people are going to be going to the polls to vote on Saturday. This is at New Bethel Church, 745 Walker Avenue in Kansas City, Kansas, or at Oak Ridge Baptist Church, 9301 Parallel Parkway. That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week. Our show is called One Job Should Be Enough, The Marriott Strike, and AT&T Legacy Workers. How about one contract? Shouldn't that be enough? But they can't get it. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman.
Still mill and dabbing with
Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.